40,000 years ago, deep within a cave, a human brain imagines something that does not exist. They grasp a large mammoth tusk in one hand, in the other hand is a sharp stone tool. They begin to carefully chip away at the ivory. This ancient human is an artist, and over many, many painstaking hours, a shape will begin to take form before them, a shape that is both familiar and strange. To begin with, they scrape and chip away at the outline of a body, human legs, a torso, a pair of arms, a head. However, as the artist starts working on the detail, it becomes clear this is no ordinary human. This is a man with the head of a fearsome cave lion. And in 1939, this ivory statue, known as the Lion Man, was discovered inside a chamber of Hollensteinstadel, a cave system in southern Germany. It is the oldest known statue of its kind ever made, and attempts at reproducing it today using Paleolithic methods have revealed it would have taken over 300 hours to produce. Clearly, it is a stunning achievement. But it also raises an obvious question. Why did someone, 40,000 years ago, take so much time to carve a human-animal hybrid, a mythical creature, into ivory? These were people living through the late Pleistocene, a time synonymous with tough glacial conditions and little in the way of comfort. Surely, these people's main priority would have been survival, finding enough food and making sure they didn't become prey. And yet, someone still found time to carve the Lion Man. When scientists analyzed the statue, they noticed the ivory was worn and polished by continuous handling. Many now think that this is a sign that the statue could have had ritualistic and spiritual significance. Perhaps it was passed around during ceremonies, or maybe it was carried around like a kind of good luck charm. But whatever its purpose was, it reminds us that even 40,000 years ago, our ancestors were human, and perhaps not so different to us. They spent time thinking about the world around them and their place within it. They had imagination, made art, and attached meaning to inanimate objects. And they cherished things that mattered to them. Even this far into the past, we can clearly see the level of consciousness our ancestors possessed. And so, just how different is our consciousness from that of other species? And when did this journey begin? Tens of thousands? Hundreds of thousands, or perhaps even millions of years ago. The artist that carved the Lion Man of Hollensteinstadel was of the Aurignacian culture, one of the first waves of modern Homo sapiens to venture out of Africa and across Europe. And a 2023 study revealed the Aurignacians were closely related to later cultures across Europe, and thus have distant relatives alive today. What does a bumblebee think about? When we think of consciousness, we don't usually think of bees or other insects. Most people probably think of mammals, like our own species, or those closely related to us, such as apes or monkeys. Insects, in the eyes of many, are just drones, going about their short lives without much of a thought, if any, for themselves. But researchers at Queen Mary University of London think that bumblebees may be more conscious than we give them credit for. The team wanted to know whether the insects would do something, not because they needed to, but because they wanted to. They set up an experiment in which the bees could choose one of three paths towards a food reward. One path was a simple straight line, free of any obstacles. But on either side of this were paths strewn with a few small wooden balls. On one side they were stationary, and on the other they could move around. The only incentive to go via any other path than the one without obstacles was if the bees wanted to interact with the wooden balls. And, amazingly, every single bee in the experiment chose to do just that. He even appeared to play with them, rolling around on them like a child on an exercise ball. The behavior had no apparent use for the survival of the bees, so according to the researchers, there was only one logical explanation. They were having fun. And so, if they make decisions based on what they want, rather than on simple instinct or survival, could we say that a bumblebee is conscious? Consciousness has puzzled scientists and philosophers for thousands of years. Long the realm of philosophy, for much of human history, it has of course been practically impossible to see what a thought looked like. But in the 1920s, German physicist Hans Berger developed the electroencephalogram, the first tool that could record human brain activity without being invasive into the skull. Berger placed electrodes on his own son's head and used a new amplifier to convert the brain's electrical signals into visible traces on paper. We could, at long last, see the mind. This line of research would continue throughout the 20th century, when electrically stimulating epileptic patients' brains in the 1940s and 50s, Wilder Penfield and Herbert Jasper found they could create experiences such as light or sound, and even elicit the vivid recall of memories. This allowed them to begin to build maps of where the sensory side of consciousness is processed in the brain. These and other experiments like them provided pieces of the mind-body puzzle, linking aspects of consciousness to areas and processes in the brain. In the 1990s, Francis Crick, one of the discoverers of DNA, and his colleague Christoph Koch coined the term neural correlates of consciousness. They sought to further the search for consciousness and ask, if it is a physical process, where are the neural correlates for this experience? Suppose you were to glance upon the majestic Victoria Falls of the Zambezi River. The neural correlates that are associated with that experience are the neurons that fire whenever a person observes, imagines, or dreams a waterfall. Thousands of these neurons can be active at the same time and in differing combinations, allowing for interaction between them. And so, the mainstream scientific consensus is that consciousness is an experience that is happening in the complex activities of neurons. But why do we have it? When did it evolve, and for what purpose? To try and answer this, we must look beyond the brain, to the outward behaviors of conscious beings. How far away from the human lineage can we cast our net and find consciousness? In the past, many had thought that only humans could be conscious. René Descartes suggested a separate physical body and thinking soul, and since animals didn't have souls, they couldn't be conscious. But more recent philosophy has re-examined this, and in 1974, the American philosopher Thomas Nagel asked, "What is it like to be a bat?" We as humans see the world through a uniquely human lens. Everything about our perspective of life is influenced by our experience of being human. From strictly biological factors like our eyesight and our sense of smell, to less tangible things like our capacity for strong emotions and our relationships with others. To know what it is like to be a human, therefore, is a question only a human knows the answer to. Just as only bats know what it is like to be a bat. And so, if there is an experience that is like being a bat, then bats, logically, must on some level be conscious. As Thomas Nagel put it, an organism has conscious mental states if, and only if, there is something that it is like to be that organism. To Nagel, that something was a subjective experience, and any organism that has its own subjective experience of being itself is conscious. But is there experimental evidence to back up this idea? In studies by Lynn Sneddon, trout injected with acid showed prolonged rubbing of the affected area, reduced feeding, and started antisocial behavior. When given painkillers, their behavior soon returned to normal. In zebrafish, injured individuals exhibited anxiety-like behavior and avoided locations associated with prior pain. Here, we can clearly see non-human species having a conscious experience, processed in the brain and shown outwardly in their behavior. Clearly, animals as alien to us as fish can learn to avoid pain, insects like bumblebees can play, and also, crabs can have favorites. Hermit crabs cannot grow shells of their own. Instead, they choose their shells from among those shared by other organisms, or even bits of plastic or litter found on the beach. And so, in a study by Barry McGee and Robert Elwood, hermit crabs were given small electric shocks to see how this would influence their behavior. Generally, they found that a couple of small shocks were enough to put a crab off its current shell and to make it leave in search of a new one where it wouldn't get shocked. So far, so predictable. But if a crab was in a shell that it particularly liked, it took considerably more electric shocks to convince it to leave. It took even more shocks to get the crabs to vacate their shells when the researchers introduced the scent of a predator into the water. On the one hand, they could leave and stop getting shocked, but risk being eaten by a predator, and on the other, they could keep being shocked, but remain safe from predation. The study therefore showed that the hermit crabs were not just having instinctual reactions to the pain, they were behaving in a remarkably relatable way, showing a conscious experience we can imagine. Crabs and bees are arthropods, animals with exoskeletons, which, along with fish, evolved in the early Cambrian, more than half a billion years ago. And so does this mean it's possible that consciousness has existed, at least in some form, for all that time? The answer is, we don't know. This is one of the great unresolved questions in biology. Did consciousness evolve once, in the common ancestor of all animals that have it today, or did it evolve many times, in different forms, across different branches of the evolutionary tree? Consciousness is costly, and brains are especially expensive to maintain. In humans, our brains use around 20% of our total energy, but make up only 2% of our body weight. For evolution to favor something so metabolically expensive, it must have offered a serious advantage. One idea is that consciousness helps animals make flexible decisions, just as hermit crabs are able to weigh up competing risks. They can ask themselves, is it better to stay in my shell and endure electric shocks, or leave and risk being eaten? Another possible advantage is in social interaction. Animals like primates, elephants, dolphins, and some birds live in complex societies. Being able to anticipate the thoughts or intentions of others, what scientists call theory of mind, could give conscious individuals a survival edge. But of course, one thing that is clear is that not all consciousness is the same. It exists on a spectrum. At one end, there might be a kind of minimal awareness that allows an animal to feel sensations, learn from them, and even make decisions based on subjective experience. A bee rolling a wooden ball for the apparent joy of it may fall into this category. Their lives would be more than just instinctive reflexes, but they would still be grounded in immediate experiences, tied closely to the here and now, or, in the case of zebrafish, a simple sense of do not go there. Human consciousness, by contrast, is of a very different order. We don't just feel, we imagine, we plan, we create. Our minds can turn an object into a symbol, a simple piece of stone into a tool, and a blank wall into an extraordinary piece of art. It's a leap into abstraction, the ability to represent things that are not physically present. And this is what some call higher order consciousness, and it is what allows us to conceive of time, selfhood, morality, myth, and art. And so while bumblebees, fish, and hermit crabs may have a form of consciousness, it's very different to our own. They hint that awareness runs deeper into evolutionary history than we might have thought, but that doesn't explain when we started being conscious in a distinctly human sense. When it comes to our own human lineage, how long has it been since we began to truly experience consciousness? as we know it today. Deep in the scorching heart of the Jordan Rift Valley, there are objects that don't seem to belong. This is Ubadiyya, a place that has not been disturbed by human hands for over a million years. Today, it is nothing but a small mound of dusty earth that looks over an expanse of dry grass. But once, a huge lake would have stretched across the landscape. All kinds of animals would have lived here. Wading birds would have tiptoed through reed beds, while hippos would have wallowed in the cool water. Evidence of such ancient diversity has been found in abundance at Ubadiyya, the skull of an imposing buffalo with giant horns, the bones of giraffe, deer, even the remains of mammoths. But among this menagerie of creatures was discovered something much stranger. For when archaeologists excavated Ubadiyya, they found a collection of stone objects with a shape unlike anything else in the surrounding environment. In stark contrast to the jagged natural rocks and even the flaked and shaped man-made choppers, scrapers and hand axe tools that were common at such sites, there were 150 stone spheres. They are made of the same kind of rock that naturally occurs here, but it's obvious, even at first glance, that these are anything but natural. Something or someone created these three-dimensional polyhedron spheroids, and not just here. They are documented all across Africa, Europe, and Asia. But who could have made them and why over a million years ago? In 1891, Eugène Dubois discovered the first ever ancient hominin fossils from outside Europe. An up-and-coming academic with an unswayable passion for human evolution, he was convinced that the missing link between Homo sapiens and our ancient ape ancestors could be found in the tropics. He spent years combing through caves and digging up muddy river sites on the Indonesian island of Sumatra. But it was on Java that he eventually found what he was looking for. On the banks of the Solo River, at a site called Trinil, Dubois and his team unearthed a small collection of hominin fossils. There was a skull cap, a thigh bone, and a tooth, all from the same individual who died hundreds of thousands of years ago. Dubois called the fossil discovery Java Man and considered it to be somewhere between an ape and a human. His long-searched-for missing link. Of course, we now understand that Dubois was pretty far off the mark with those assumptions. In the 1950s, after more hominin fossils had been added to the record, it was decided that Java Man actually belonged to just one of many different hominin species that existed. Homo erectus. A hominin who spread across the world from roughly 2 million to 100,000 years ago. But just how human was Homo erectus? In 2014, researchers from Leiden University in the Netherlands re-examined the Java Man collection. It turned out that Dubois also found almost a dozen shells belonging to a species of extinct bivalve, a mussel-like creature that lived around 500,000 years ago. The research team, led by Josephine Jordans, noticed some markings on one of the shells that were conspicuously absent from Dubois' description of the Java Man collection. Nearly invisible to the naked eye and resembling geometric zigzags, Jordans and her team came to the conclusion that the markings weren't there by accident. Someone, 500,000 years ago, had deliberately carved them into the shell. In fact, it's thought that whoever engraved it also used the shell as a tool, because the round edges appear to have been intentionally sharpened. And so Jordan's study calls to mind the image of an ancient human, a Homo erectus, sitting on a riverbank, their brow furrowed in concentration as they carefully engrave a pattern onto a shell. Maybe they found the shell a few weeks before and decided it would make a useful tool. Perhaps they liked it so much, they decided to decorate it with intricate patterns. Or maybe the markings were put there to identify it as their shell, and nobody else's. But whatever the case, it's clear that at least some degree of conscious thought went into the production of the engraved shell tool. Some even think that the engravings could be classed as something very human. Art. Artistic expression, as well as the capacity for symbolic or abstract thought, is thought by many scholars to be what distinguishes our own species, Homo sapiens, from other, closely related hominins. Making art signals the presence of a mind that can deal with symbols, not just sensations. To make or understand an artwork, you must allow a mark, sound, or gesture stand for something that is not present. That leap from the concrete to the abstract is the signature of symbolic thought. It shows that people can detach meaning from the immediate and bind it to conventions that others share. But artifacts like the engraved shell from Java, which was made many hundreds of thousands of years before Homo sapiens even existed, bring that assumption under scrutiny. Indeed, if consciousness the same as our own, or consciousness that was at least very similar, existed 500,000 years ago in Homo erectus, could it be even older? And this is where we can return to the collection of spheres found in Ubudaya. In 2023, a team of researchers, led by Antoine Muller from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, published a paper in the journal Royal Society Open Science, revealing that a human species intentionally shaped the 150 spheroid stones from Ubudaya some 1.4 million years ago. The archaeologists found that they were not naturally formed, nor the accidental byproduct of repeated hammering. Instead, the spheroids were carefully shaped in a deliberate sequence. The archaeologists said that the stones exhibited a regularity suggestive of a deliberate intention to craft geometric shapes. Such regularity and attention to geometry indicate that Homo erectus was capable of imagining a desired outcome and methodically working towards it. Other than these three spheroids, Homo erectus also made symmetrical hand axes, teardrop-shaped stone tools that could be used for cutting and chopping. Olduan tools, made by earlier species like Homo habilis, were probably just as functional, but lacked the symmetric shape of hand axes. And so why would Homo erectus make symmetrical artifacts? The answer may be very simple. They thought they looked good. The symmetry of hand axes and the near perfection of the stone spheres suggests that Homo erectus may have appreciated aesthetics for its own sake. And yet, Homo erectus' brains were often considerably smaller than our own. Although there was a lot of diversity in their brain size throughout time and across space, as you might expect for such a long-lived and widespread species, Homo erectus' brain volumes averaged around 900 cubic centimeters. Modern human brains, meanwhile, average around 1200 cubic centimeters. Although, what matters more than size is structure and organization. Endocasts, which show the internal shape of the skull, demonstrate that Homo erectus brains already had a lot in common with our own, including enlarged frontal lobes, which house the prefrontal cortex, one of the regions Cork and Crick believe is critical for consciousness and which is most associated with planning, decision-making, and social behavior. At the same time, though, there were structural differences. Homo erectus brains lacked some of the complexity and expanded surface area seen in Homo sapiens. This likely meant less capacity for rapid symbolic communication, fine-grained memory, or the subtle layering of abstract thought on which culture depends. In short, Homo erectus minds may not have been filled with the same constant dialogue and recursive imagination that define our experiences of consciousness today. And yet, if Homo erectus could make art, their subjective experience was certainly not the same as a bee rolling a wooden ball. Their brains suggest a consciousness that was recognizably human in its foundations. Perhaps they lived slightly more in the present moment than we do, But on this evidence, we can speculate that they still carried minds capable of reaching beyond the immediate into symbolism, aesthetics, and intentional creation. It seems at least the beginning of higher order consciousness dates to well over a million years ago, and may have first evolved in our Homo erectus ancestors. And if we trace our lineage forwards, we can also find clues that our advancing cognition was helping us to survive. Our story now takes us to a collection of waterlogged fossils near Kalambo Falls in Zambia. This site has been dated to around 470,000 years ago, around 150,000 years earlier than the oldest Homo sapien fossils. So it would appear the minds at work here are not yet of our species. No bones have been discovered at this site, but Homo erectus, Homo heidelbergensis, and Homo naledi are possible contenders. Or perhaps it was an as yet unidentified hominin species. "This find has changed how I think about our early ancestors," said Professor Larry Barham, leader of the research team. For here in Zambia, he found the earliest evidence for structural use of wood in the archaeological record. Our ancestors were building. Two wooden logs were uncovered, lying at right angles with a notch cut into the upper log that allowed them to slot together, much like the logs of a wooden cabin. "It's hard to tell what sort of structure it might have been," remarked Professor Jeff Duller. "It might be some sort of structure to sit beside the river and fish. We may never know exactly what the structure was or what it was used for. Possibly for fishing, storage, sleeping, or other activities. But what we can be relatively sure of is that a species that existed before our own used their consciousness to create something that likely aided their survival." Professor Barham concluded, "They used their intelligence, imagination, and skills to create something they'd never seen before, something that had never previously existed." And so it would seem that we can look to human species other than our own and find what might be signs of art or ownership, as well as planning and design. Yet as remarkable as these cognitive capacities were, they also raise profound questions about what truly set Homo sapiens apart. We are, after all, the only remaining hominin species on the planet, and our specific quality of consciousness likely had a major part to play in our survival. So what explosions of consciousness, culture, and creativity took shape solely within our own lineage? Rising above the French town of Montagnac is a hill covered in leafy green trees. And in 1940, 18-year-old Marcel Rabada was walking up this hill with his dog. They'd only made it about halfway up, however, when the dog suddenly darted off the path. Marcel found the animal sniffing around a small hole in the ground, initially thinking it was a fox den. After peering down the hole into inky blackness, he began to wonder if his furry friend had discovered something else. Hurrying back down the hill and into town, Marcel told his friends about what he had found, and a few days later, he and two other boys returned to the opening and spent an hour removing the centuries of debris and sediment that had blocked it up. Eventually, the hole was just about big enough for Marcel to squeeze inside. Switching on his electric torch, he was astonished to see hundreds of animals – aurochs, bison, elk, and horses painted on the walls of a cave that had lain quiet and undisturbed for thousands of years. It was Lascaux, and the artists were ancient Homo sapiens, nearly 22,000 years ago. Although we will never be able to know the exact reasons why they decided to create the art at Lascaux, it's evident that these were people who felt deeply connected to the world around them. Not only did they appreciate the beauty of the animals they shared the landscape with, they imagined patterns and symbols and used ochre paints to bring them into existence. These were clearly intelligent, clearly conscious people. This is undoubtedly an example of modern consciousness. And so what then distinguishes this form of consciousness from that of our evolutionary relatives? Archaeology shows that other, earlier species of human may have experienced something akin to our consciousness. Yet there are crucial features that set Homo sapiens apart. Most notably, the extraordinary depth and breadth of our symbolic expression through art, ritual, and spirituality. While it remains conceivable that our ancestors engaged in creative or spiritual practices, the archaeological record provides only scant and ambiguous hints, a pattern here or there, but little of striking significance. By contrast, the legacy of our Homo sapien ancestors is an explosion of imagery, symbolism, and meaning preserved across hundreds of cave walls and artifacts. It's not merely a matter of crafting images or objects for their beauty, but of assigning them meaning where there was none before. It is these elements of our minds that distinguish Homo sapiens from every other creature that has ever inhabited the planet. And so when exactly did this cognitive transformation occur? Were Homo sapiens always imbued with such consciousness, or did it evolve slowly? In the mid-20th century, one particular theory for the origins of human consciousness was widely accepted. It suggested that Homo sapiens became behaviorally modern relatively recently in prehistory. According to the theory, behavioral modernity evolved abruptly around 40,000 years ago, through a human revolution that arose in Ice Age Europe during the Upper Paleolithic. Europe's archaeological record revealed a flourishing of figurative cave art and engraved artifacts, contrasting sharply with the scarcity of such evidence in the earlier Paleolithic record. This seemed to signal a cognitive leap unique to Homo sapiens upon their arrival into Europe after leaving Africa. Today, however, this model has been overturned, for archaeological evidence tells a much older, more complex story. Perched high on the cliffs overlooking South Africa's Mossel Bay, the caves of Pinnacle Point once provided sanctuary for ancient humans struggling to survive during a long ice age. Between 195 and 123,000 years ago, Africa's interior grew increasingly arid and inhospitable, and Homo sapien populations dwindled dangerously, DNA evidence even suggesting that our species could have been at risk of extinction. But along the coasts, small groups of hardy people were able to survive. Here they harvested shellfish and marine plants, and when they weren't looking for food, the people at Pinnacle Point built hearths and made new kinds of stone tools that could be attached to shafts of wood and used as projectile weapons. But that was not all. They were also doing something that over 160,000 years later caught the attention of paleoanthropologist Curtis Marion. Marion had started his career in Eastern Africa, but after learning about the severe population bottleneck our species experienced between 195 and 123,000 years ago, he started looking for places that could have sustained groups of Homo sapiens during this time. This search led him to South Africa, and in 1999, he and a colleague, Peter Nielsen, decided to explore the caves at Pinnacle Point. Together, they scrambled down a sheer cliff face and were immediately rewarded by evidence of ancient human occupation. What emerged from the excavations was staggering. Not only were there hearths and stone tools, but also human remains and dozens of chunks of ochre. Ochre is a natural pigment derived from iron-rich stone and comes in a variety of shades, ranging from earthy brown and yellow to bright red and deep black. The ochre at Pinnacle Point bore clear signs of grinding and scraping by human hands, meaning that it had been processed and used. For a long time, archaeologists have understood the significance of pigment in human consciousness. As a species, we are drawn to color. We find beauty in it, but we also assign symbolic meaning to it. Red, for example, is seen by many cultures around the world as the color of luck, vitality, and protection. And it seems that our fascination with this vibrant hue spans hundreds of thousands of years. Many burials dated to the Upper Paleolithic period contain red ochre, including the famous Red Lady of Paviland burial from South Wales and the Sungir burials from Russia, both of which date to around 30,000 years ago. Archaeologists think that the presence of red ochre in these burials, along with grave goods like beads and carved ornaments, is a clear sign of ritualistic behavior. And so the discovery of ochre at Pinnacle Point suggested that the site's ancient inhabitants were capable of similar symbolic rituals. But the real revelation was in the age of the ochre itself. For modern dating methods revealed, it was an astonishing 164,000 years old. Clearly, despite enduring extreme hardships that nearly wiped out their entire species, the people of Pinnacle Point were doing a lot more than just surviving. Curtis Marion believes that they were using the ochre to decorate themselves and their belongings, and in so doing were expressing identity, community, and perhaps even spirituality. Several other sites in South Africa have yielded ancient ochre, some of it also dating to before 100,000 years ago. Intriguingly, most of this ochre is red, despite the fact that local mineral sources come in a wide spectrum of colours. Jocelyn Bernaches of Arizona State University has even gone as far as to suggest that some of these pieces of ochre may have originally been yellow, but were heat-treated to turn them red. Of course, we can only ever guess at these people's reasoning, but it seems likely that red was a special colour to them, just as it still is for people today. And even this period of 100 to 164,000 years ago is still not the beginning of the evidence. Scientists have discovered some usage of red ochre as ancient as 500,000 years ago, though always with less than 100 pieces of ochre at any one site. Of course, at this point in history, the humans living at Pinnacle Point were not primitive in their biological makeup. They were anatomically modern Homo sapiens, meaning their bodies and brains closely resembled our own. Indeed, the size and structure of their brains had already reached modern proportions, with an average cranial capacity of around 1300 to 1500 cubic centimeters. And so this means that while their cultures and technologies may appear simple compared to our own, they likely had very similar cognitive potential to modern humans. Neural structures supporting language, memory, imagination, and abstract thought were likely already in place, meaning our ancestors were capable of symbolic behaviors, complex communication, and potentially even art and spiritual ideas, although it's true that such early expressions rarely survive in the archaeological record. However, it's also true that brain size isn't everything. Social connectivity also plays a factor. Genetic analysis of mitochondrial DNA and other genomic markers from diverse African populations reveal that between roughly 80,000 and 60,000 years ago, there was a sharp increase in human population density, likely originating from a relatively small region in Africa. This density drove a higher encounter rate between humans, creating wider social networks that allowed higher degrees of skill transfer between them. Also, around 70,000 years ago, there is evidence that humans began exploiting a wider variety of habitats across the African continent, including dense forests in western central Africa, deserts to the north, and diverse temperature zones. This expansion is believed to coincide with more favorable environmental conditions, which allowed population growth and encouraged Homo sapiens to develop new, flexible technology that helped them become more resilient to ecological change and diversity. And following this period of growth and dispersal, we begin to see something new. Art that is truly figurative. One of the most striking examples comes from Sulawesi in Indonesia. Deep in a cave, archaeologists discovered a life-sized painting of a warty pig, an animal that was surely important to the local people for food and other resources. The painting is estimated to be at least 45,500 years old, although some estimates put it closer to 50,000. The pig, rendered in dark red ochre with realistic features, is part of a scene that seems to depict human figures interacting with animals. It almost appears to tell a story. And indeed, it was just a few thousand years later that the ancient people of Germany made the famous Lion Man of Hollenstein-Stadel. And so why do signs of advanced consciousness like these appear more frequently later in the archaeological record? Is it really only down to issues with preservation, with newer evidence simply being more well preserved, or is the answer more nuanced? Could the solution lie in the shape of our brains? Scientists believe that the brains of our ancient ancestors may have always been roughly the same size as ours, but the shape of their skulls suggested different internal organization. Over time, there was a shift towards a more globular brain shape in Homo sapiens, which we still have today. But 300,000 years ago, near the very origin of our species, Homo sapiens found at Jebel Irhoud in Morocco had far more elongated brain cases, more akin to the shape we see in other human species. Some scholars argue that the less globular brain shape of the very early Homo sapiens, like those at Jebel Irhoud, implies that key features of modern consciousness and neural processing were not fully developed. This could have affected language, planning, and creativity, which then grew as our brains reorganized with the change in skull shape. However, other research finds a weakening link between our biology and behavior over the last 300,000 years. A 2023 review of the fossil record by Eleanor Sherry and Manuel Will found that the archaeological record bears no direct relation to a simplistic shift in the human brain. This review found that human behavioral complexity does increase over time, but not as a gradual evolution in line with physiology, but what they called a variable expression, with a complex pattern of periods of advancement and stagnation. They found that the fossil evidence concurs with the genetic analysis that predicted encounter rates, pointing to factors such as population structure, size, and connectivity being the key for the development of our complex behaviors. It appears likely, then, that the evolution of consciousness and behavior throughout the time of Homo sapiens was neither a giant leap nor a gradual incline, but a complex pattern enabled by the size of our brains, but driven by social structure and connectivity. Over many thousands of years, the human conscious experience as we know it today was built by the interactions of humans. It is undeniable that our species has accomplished amazing things. The creations of our ancestors even tens of thousands of years ago speak to a level of self-awareness, imagination, and symbolic thought that defines our species' journey through evolution. They mark us as beings who do not just live in the world, but actively shape it with meaning, as no other species ever has. In this sense, we stand alone. Or do we? Does the consciousness of Homo sapiens truly stand apart, or was there once another species whose minds were just like ours? The cave is deathly quiet. Only the drip of water and the shuffling of feet break the stillness. A small group of people are carrying something. A body shrouded in soft animal furs. The procession is awkward, the body is heavy and the cave floor is slippery, but the people work together to bear the weight. They gently lay the body down on a soft patch of earth, and one of them pulls back the shroud to reveal the face of a man. For a long moment, they all stand silently, gazing at his still features. He had been a father, a teacher, a hunter. Now, he is gone. From the piles they have carried in, an elderly woman chooses small wildflowers, yellow, purple, and white. She places them one by one around his arms and shoulders. Others bring herbs, grasses, and soft leaves, scattering them over the body. The group works in near silence as they cover him with stone and packed earth. Soon, he and his flowers will have vanished beneath the soil, but his people will remember him, and they have honored him in death. Back in the 1950s and 1960s, archaeologist Ralph Selecki uncovered human skeletons in Shanidar Cave in Iraq, and analysis of the soil around one of them showed unusually dense clusters of pollen from multiple species of flowering plants. The presence and diversity of pollen was interpreted as evidence that flowers had been deliberately placed on and around the body, like offerings to the spirit of the dead, possibly indicating that it was a ritualized burial. The so-called flower burial was just one of several graves excavated at Shanidar, all of them showing compelling evidence of deliberate burial. But the people buried in the cave were not Homo sapiens. They were Neanderthals. Right from the start, the Shanidar burials were controversial, and indeed more modern studies have argued against this hypothesis. But what might it mean for our understanding of human consciousness if Neanderthals were capable of behaviour once thought to be unique to our own species, Homo sapiens? If they performed rituals and held spiritual beliefs, could they also have made art, thought abstractly, and communicated through symbols? For a long time, researchers thought of Neanderthals as transitional ape men, or missing links. But today, an ever-growing body of evidence supports a very different interpretation. Instead of the brutish caveman, imagine someone wearing a headdress of striking eagle feathers, their pale skin decorated with red paint. The face looking back at you does indeed have a protruding brow and a larger-than-average nose, but there was also the sparkle of keen intelligence in their clear blue eyes. Around their neck and decorating their strong arms are strings of polished eagle talons, shells, and ivory beads, while the tool they grasp is a long spear, hafted with a sharp stone point. From what we know now, this is a more accurate depiction of a Neanderthal, a fellow human species that, possibly, was just as conscious as we are. As Ralph Selecki said after his discovery of the Shanidar flower burial, although the body was archaic, the spirit was modern. Apart from the more controversial Shanidar, much of the most compelling evidence we have that Neanderthals expressed advanced consciousness comes from their art and perceived decoration. On Spain's southeastern coast, there is a wave-battered cave known as the Cueva de los Aviones. The cave first drew the interest of archaeologists in the 1980s because it contained evidence of Neanderthal occupation dating back to the Pleistocene. Since that time, its rocky walls have seen many excavation teams come and go, but nothing groundbreaking was found until much later, 30 years after the first excavations began. In 2010, a research team led by Portuguese archaeologist João Zilhão discovered an assemblage of ancient marine shells inside the cave. Finding shells inside a sea cave might not have come as much of a surprise, but the researchers noticed that many of the shells had strange-looking holes in them. The holes were all of similar shapes and sizes, and all in the same position on the shells. The researchers knew that there was no natural process, such as erosion or predation, that could explain these holes, leaving them with one logical answer: that humans had intentionally perforated them. To add another layer of intrigue, the team also found lumps of pigment, red, yellow, and black ochre, and subsequent analysis revealed traces of these pigments on and inside the shells, suggesting that they had once been painted. Zilhão and his colleagues published their findings and presented the perforated shells as evidence of symbolic behaviour in the Neanderthals who once occupied the cave, speculating that the shells were used to make a necklace or a bracelet. Not only this, but radiocarbon dating indicated that they had done it at least 50,000 years ago, before Homo sapiens had even arrived in continental Europe by the conventional wisdom of the time. What followed was a tidal wave of criticism and controversy. Some researchers tried to suggest that maybe Homo sapiens had been present in the Spanish cave 50,000 years ago after all, but there is no evidence of Homo sapiens ever setting foot in the cave, whereas there is plenty of evidence for Neanderthals using it. Others sought an alternative explanation, Perhaps Neanderthals had made the artifacts, but they did so because they had previously met Homo sapiens and copied them. This is a theory known as acculturation, which argues that Neanderthals simply imitated the more advanced and intelligent Homo sapiens. They could therefore have made the shells at Cueva de los Aviones, but didn't have the conscious ability to assign symbolic meaning to them. They were simply soulless copies of what Homo sapiens made. This debate continued for several more years, until eventually a new study was published that erased all doubt that Neanderthals were the true makers and designers of the shell artifacts. In 2018, Dirk Hoffman and his team, who specialize in dating ancient materials, reanalyzed the shells from the cave and were astonished when a new, much older date for them came back from the lab. For years, some archaeologists had argued that the shells were indeed made by Neanderthals, but that there may have been a problem with the reliability of radiocarbon dating. This method is infamous for its limitations, and can only reliably date objects up to around 40 to 50,000 years ago. For anything older, it can only provide a minimum date. And so Hoffman's team used a different method, uranium-thorium dating, which estimated the age of the flowstone that had formed over the archaeological layers of the site. The results were startling. The shells and the ochre had been deposited at least 115 to 120,000 years ago. The team compared their findings to symbolic artifacts from South Africa, such as shell beads from Blombos Cave, which are considered to be early signs of advanced human consciousness in Homo sapiens. But the artifacts from Cueva de los Aviones predate the Blombos discoveries by tens of thousands of years. This series of discoveries led Hoffman and his team to a bold conclusion: that Neanderthals were not only capable of creating symbolic art and personal decoration, they were doing so long before modern humans arrived in Europe. Acculturation, therefore, was impossible. And if that wasn't convincing enough evidence, Hoffman and his colleagues went on to publish another bombshell paper less than 24 hours after the first one. At Cueva de los Aviones, excavations not only uncovered painted and perforated shells, but also sections of cave wall adorned with red pigment. There were lines, dots, discs, and a geometric design that had been hidden deep within the cave's recesses and had gone unnoticed for decades since the cave was first explored by archaeologists. Red ochre was mixed with water and applied to the rock in swirls, dots, and patches. Some motifs seemed to represent ladders or networks, others arrays of discs, and there were even hand stencils, where a Neanderthal pressed their hand to the stone and blew pigment over it. The careful placement, choice of color, and clear planning required for these paintings surely reveal minds capable of abstract thought and symbolic communication. Cueva de los Aviones is one of four Spanish cave sites included in Hoffman's paper, along with La Pasiega, Maltravieso, and Ardiles, all of which contain paintings. Archaeologists had discovered art in the other caves years earlier, but the paintings had long been assumed to have been made by Homo sapiens. Hoffman and his team, however, analyzed the paintings from all four sites to find out just how old they really were. The paintings from Cueva de los Aviones are at least 65,000 years old, while the paintings from the other Spanish caves came back with similar dates. And that made them around 20,000 years older than the oldest known painting made by Homo sapiens, the 45,000-year-old art from Sulawesi in Indonesia. And so, accepting that Neanderthals created art and symbolic objects, possibly even before Homo sapiens did, presents the ultimate challenge to the long-standing view that symbolic expression, creativity, and abstract thinking were all unique hallmarks of modern human consciousness. Yet, undoubtedly, Neanderthals had very different brains. Their skulls did not have the smooth, rounded shape associated with modern humans. They were elongated and had a prominent bump at the back, known as an occipital bun. These features reflected major differences in the shape and structure of the brains, especially in the frontal lobe. Indeed, Neanderthals actually had larger brains on average than modern humans, measuring in at around 1400 to 1600 cubic centimeters, which is up to 200 cubic centimeters bigger than ours. However, as we have seen before, having a larger brain doesn't automatically mean greater intelligence. The shape and internal organization of the brain played a crucial role in how cognition developed. For example, Neanderthals had larger areas in their brains devoted to vision and movement. Their robust bodies and rugged environments demanding sharp eyesight and fine motor control, meaning that much of their neural real estate was devoted to those tasks. In other parts of the brain, areas associated with language, social reasoning, and complex thinking, like the cerebellum, were proportionally smaller compared to modern humans. Some researchers think that such differences in structural organization could have influenced Neanderthal cognition and behavior, although it's impossible to know for sure. Indeed, perhaps, rather than being limited by the differences in their brain structure, Neanderthals were made more sensitive and perceptive by them. Since their brains suggest a heightened capacity for sensory and visual processing, maybe their capacity for symbolic behavior could have been rooted in a different kind of consciousness, one that emphasizes rich sensory detail over the flexibility that characterizes Homo sapiens. And so, does the possibility of Neanderthal consciousness open the door to other human species? For example, what about the Denisovans? Denisovans are not well understood. They were not discovered until 2010, when a genetic study of a tiny finger bone excavated from Denisova Cave in Siberia revealed a new species. As discovery of their physical remains grows, evidence for symbolic thought is scant, but not entirely absent. Two mammalian rib bone fragments found at Lingjing in China suggest that the Denisovans could have been making art over 100,000 years ago. In 2019, engravings were discovered on the bones, which were produced by a sharp tool. Not only that, but ochre residue was found, particularly along the engraved lines, suggesting that the Denisovan individual who carved them added pigment to further highlight them. If consciousness is to be understood as the ability to reflect, to create meaning, and to experience the world beyond immediate survival needs, then archaeological evidence seems to expand it beyond Homo sapiens alone. Perhaps, therefore, it is time to open a door to a version of consciousness that is not exclusive to our own species, but is part of a mosaic of evolving minds. Our brain's deepest mysteries, truly ancient, and shared with our evolutionary cousins.